inviting me, and thanks for coming to my talk. I'm going to be talking about CMB lensing measurements, past and future, and what they can tell us about cosmology. And this is work done in collaboration with David Spergel, Sudeep Das, Joe Dunkley, a number of other people from the ACT and Polar Bear collaborations. So before I start talking about CMB lensing, my main topic, let me just advertise that there are a few other things I worked on, such as the Sunyaev-Zeldovich effect and its non-Gaussian signatures, baryon acoustic oscillations, and other aspects of CMB data analysis. So if you're not interested in CMB lensing but are interested in one of these, also please feel free to come talk to me after the talk. I'm in office number 227. So, but now let me give an introduction to CMB lensing. So as you all know, more than 80% of the matter in our universe is not made up of the sort of visible matter that makes up everyday objects, but is made up of invisible dark matter, which at least on large scales only interacts through gravity, as far as we know. And that makes it incredibly difficult to study. The structures of dark matter that we can sort of see in our simulations and that we expect to be there, the sort of large filamentary structures that make up the cosmic web. And the best way we currently have of studying the large-scale distribution of dark matter, the large-scale cosmic web, is through gravitational lensing. And gravitational lensing, as I'm sure you also know, is when gravity deflects radiation as it passes by a distribution of mass or dark matter. And so in my talk, I'll be focusing on the gravitational lensing of a particular kind of radiation, namely the cosmic microwave background. So as the photons of the cosmic microwave background travel from the last scattering surface through the universe, they're gravitationally deflected by the large-scale structure distribution through which they pass. And so a CMB photon that we see today has experienced many, many small deflections on its way to us that have remapped the CMB sky that we observe from the way it originally looked. And to sort of illustrate what this effect looks like, here's a simulation of just a 10 by 10 degree patch of sky, of CMB sky. Here's the CMB temperature, the hot and cold spots. And this is what it would look like without lensing. And now let me turn on the gravitational lensing of the microwave background due to large-scale structure. And you can compare and see how big an effect that is. So it's got a particularly huge effect. But you do notice a difference. Hopefully, you'll notice that the CMB hot and cold spots are kind of shifted by just a few arc minutes. And you'll also notice that big degree scale blobs of the sky are kind of moved together coherently. This lensing deflection defines a convenient observable, which is a two-dimensional vector field, the lensing deflection field, which points from the direction in which you see a CMB photon to the direction in which it was originally emitted in the absence of lensing. Right, so you see this remapping equation here. Let me actually grab the hockey stick to point. So the lensing deflection field is a convenient observable, and as I've mentioned, the deflections are arc minute scale but coherent over degree scales. So why is it interesting to measure this lensing deflection field? Why do we care about measuring the lensing deflection field on the sky? Well, it turns out that the amount of lensing deflection, as you might suspect, tells you about the projected matter density in that same direction, all the way out to very high redshifts. So it really is sensitive to the mass over a very, very wide range of redshifts, all the way from redshift 0.3 out to very high redshifts around 5. So what that means is if we can figure out the lensing deflection, if we can figure out how the CMB has been deflected, we can determine the projected distribution of dark matter. And this...
Is this sensitive to things like biasing?
Are you talking about galaxy bias? No, because you're directly gravitationally measuring the mass distribution. So this is a purely gravitational measurement, effectively, of the potentials. And so it doesn't depend on things like biases, and that's one of the main advantages.
So it's more sensitive to dark matter rather than baryons?
Yes, it's sensitive to mass, and in particular, that obviously is mainly dark matter. So sometimes I'll say dark matter when I mean mass. So why is it interesting to know the large-scale mass distribution? Why do we care about that? Well, as hopefully I'll illustrate in this talk, the large-scale distribution of mass really encodes in it some really interesting physics, some really interesting cosmology that will help us answer, or at least address, hopefully, some of the most important questions in cosmology, such as, you know, why is the universe accelerating, and what are the properties of neutrinos? So these are the, you know, most important questions chosen by the NAS Decadal Survey. And so hopefully I can illustrate a little bit of what CMB lensing can tell us about these questions in my talk. So in the first half of my talk, I'll kind of talk about CMB lensing past. So what has been done so far in the field? I'll talk a bit about my work on ACT, which was sort of very early CMB lensing work. Then I'll talk about Planck, which has been a huge step forward. And I'll discuss how measurements of the lensing power spectrum, as well as cross correlations, can tell us about cosmology. And then I'll kind of switch gears a bit and talk about what's coming up in terms of CMB lensing. I'll discuss some ongoing work that sort of measures the CMB lensing not in through the CMB temperature, but through the CMB polarization. And I'll discuss both current work and stuff that's going to be coming out in the next year or two. So I hope I've motivated a bit why it's interesting to measure the lensing deflection field, why it's interesting to measure lensing, because it tells you about the large-scale distribution of mass, and that encodes a lot of interesting cosmological information. But how can you do that? How can you measure the lensing deflection field in the sky, right? In the real universe, I can't switch back and forth between the lens CMB and the unlens CMB. I don't know what the unlens CMB looks like. So how does that work? Well, we can make use of the fact that we really understand the statistical properties of the unlensed CMB sky, of the CMB before lensing, that are modified by gravitational lensing. So in particular, if you we know that the CMB has no preferred direction. So there's no we know that it's statistically isotropic. The CMB hot and cold spots don't have a preferred direction. So if I construct a statistic such as the correlation between the temperature and its gradient, I'd expect to see zero, right? There can't be a preferred direction. But now if I deflect the CMB hot and cold spots, there is a preferred direction locally, which is this lensing deflection direction. And so you can show that if you look at the correlation between the temperature and its gradient, with lensing, it's now proportional to the deflection field. So lensing can be measured because it changes the very well-understood statistics of the CMB hot and cold spots. And so you can use this change in the statistical properties of the CMB hot and cold spots due to lensing to construct a noisy estimate of the lensing deflection field on the sky. And that works exactly as you expect. You sort of just measure the correlation between the temperature and its gradient, and that gives you a noisy estimate of the lensing deflection field. Now, I'm really, really simplifying here. There's a lot of sort of details on how the filtering comes in and the normalization and how exactly you do this, but that's sort of a kind of sketch of what you actually do in practice. So using this quadratic estimator that correlates the temperature and its gradient, you can take a map of the cosmic microwave background temperature, hot and cold spots, and estimate a map of the lensing, a map of the lensing deflection on the sky. So here I'm always plotting the modulus of this vector field. And that's exactly what we did in 2011 for CMB temperature maps from the Atacama Cosmology Telescope. So as you can see here, ACT, or the Atacama Cosmology Telescope, measures the CMB to much higher resolution than something like WMAP or Planck. So it measures the small-scale CMB fluctuation. And we constructed a pipeline that was designed to be as insensitive as possible to various systematic errors that took these ACT maps and spat out a lensing deflection field. Something that's worth noting is that the small-scale CMB temperature fluctuations tell you about the large-scale lenses, right? So it's not like the same scales. It's not like information at one scale tells you about the same scale in lensing. No. By how the small-scale CMB fluctuations are distorted, you can figure out the large-scale distribution of lenses. OK, so we recovered a lensing map from the Atacama Cosmology Telescope temperature maps. So we have this ACT lensing map. What can we do with it? How can we get cosmology out of it? Well, there's sort of two main techniques to do to get cosmology from a lensing map. And the first one is measure just the autocorrelation or the power spectrum of this map. And the second one is cross-correlate this lensing map with another field that also depends on the underlying mass distribution, such as...
You were showing and you're saying, and here it is pre-constructed, that you're giving absolute value of delta. Do you actually measure the vectorial value?
Basically there's sort of one degree of freedom, which is effectively like a potential, right? And I can give you either the potential or the electric field or the modulus of the electric field. There's just one, so I can plot anything and convert that to anything else. But effectively, it's enough to plot the modulus. What I'm actually plotting here is.
I mean, if you found a vector field that was not the gradient.
Yeah, that's right. So that's one of the ways you search for systematics. You reconstruct the sort of curl. If you can look for a sort of curl polarization, the curl lensing, and if you find that, then you know there's something going wrong, and that's actually one of the key systematic tests we do. But I'm simplifying here somewhat. So actually, I'm plotting the gradient filtered modulus, which is sort of the lensing convergence, which is most nicely related to the mass distribution. So I'm somewhat simplifying here. Actually, I'm plotting the lensing convergence. If you know about lensing. But there's only one degree of freedom. It doesn't matter. I can plot anything and convert it to anything else. So as I was saying, you measure a lensing map, you can measure its power spectrum, and you can cross-correlate it with things. So first I'm going to talk about measurements of the lensing power spectrum and what they can tell you about cosmology for some early examples with ACT and then also for Planck. So with ACT in 2011, we started looking to measure the lensing power spectrum for the first time. So Kendrick here in the audience had detected this lensing signature in cross-correlation a couple of years earlier, but the lensing power spectrum had never been measured. And so we detected it at around 4 sigma for the first time, as you can see in these data points in red. ACT continued to observe, though, so the detection significance and the precision went up a little bit just by adding more data. And so why was this first detection in 2011 of the lensing power spectrum that Sudeep Das and I worked on interesting? Why is it an interesting thing to measure? Well, the lensing power spectrum basically tells you about how big are the fluctuations of dark matter at redshift 2, right? They tell you about the structures of dark matter at redshift 2 in a very, very nice and clean gravitational way. So it's a really, really interesting probe of cosmology that directly gets at the distribution of dark matter at high redshift. So it's sort of a unique probe. And I think it's kind of remarkable that, just as a cross-check of the Lambda CDM model, right? So we take our measurements of the primordial CMB at redshift 1,000, the WMAP parameters, say, and we predict what that means for the structures of dark matter or mass at redshift 2. And that's, this theory line in black. And as you can see, the theory for what these structures should look like agrees with what we measure. So it's actually kind of remarkable. And it gets even more impressive how well we can predict the structures at redshift 2 if you look at the Planck power spectrum. Yes? What was that?
That peak in the CR correlation.
No, so this is basically a projected matter power spectrum. So basically, it corresponds to matter radiation equality, effectively where that turnover in the matter power spectrum happens. Right. So if you look at the the matter power spectrum, it has like.
Is this correlation comes from lens?
Yeah. So I measure a lensing. Yes. I measure a lensing map. Okay. And then there are these big, there's these structures I see, and then I measure the power spectrum, right? Which tells me, How big are the fluctuations in mass in projection on what angular scale, right? So this is telling you that most of the blobs in my lensing map are, order a degree or something, and that's just reflecting the fact that the dark matter distribution looks like that due to how it's
formed. So you mean I took K equality, which is like 0.01 inverse megaparsecs, and then did K to L with the right distance to the CMB. It's just the angular version of K equality and mass power.
Yeah, pretty much, I think.
Right.
Yeah, you just plug in that and sort of the matter power spectrum.
Is it because you assume it's lambda CDM, then you know when the structure formation is the most important on the left? Or if I put another dark energy model, would it change?
Right, so obviously this theory line assumes some kind of physical model for what the structure formation is and what the lensing is, and that's the standard vanilla lambda CDM model. If you have different dark energy properties or things like that, then it'll change, and I'll talk about that as well.
What if you change your space-time from MLW to something slightly anisotropic?
I assume if it affects the metric, it would also affect the lensing, but this is average, so maybe you wouldn't notice that. Anyway, let me get moving again. Right, so as I was saying, it's kind of amazing that just a year and a half after we first measured this lensing power spectrum, the signal-to-noise increased from 4 sigma detection to a 25 sigma detection. And you can see that Planck was a huge step forward in measuring the lensing power spectrum, sort of brought it into the era of precision cosmology. So it's really nice that since our first measurement, so much progress has been made. But even when we made this first measurement, we wondered, can we get any interesting cosmological constraints from measuring the lensing power spectrum, which is just the measurement of the projected dark matter power spectrum, right? And we thought, well, we were wondering, in the era of precision cosmology, is a 4 sigma measurement, can we really learn anything from that? And in fact, you can if you ask the question, what information about dark energy can you get from just the CMB alone? You just look at the microwave background, you don't include things like supernovae or BAO or any kind of other low redshift probe. And until recently, the answer was not very much at all, because of what's known as the geometric degeneracy, which tells you that a standard flat lambda CDM model with dark energy and a curve model without dark energy can give you basically the really, really nearly identical CMB temperature and polarization power spectra. What's going on here? What's the origin of this geometric degeneracy? Effectively, if you look at what the CMB power spectrum constrains, it really only constrains late time parameters such as dark energy and or lambda and curvature through the angular scale that the peaks are projected onto, which basically tells you about the angular diameter distance to redshift 1100. So it turns out that different combinations of dark energy and curvature can give you the same angular diameter distance. And that leads to this well-known degeneracy line. Geometric degeneracy is often shown in the omega-lambda, omega-matter plane. You can see these two models are basically degenerate from WMAP, even though ISW and other things do somewhat favor lambda CDM. But what's remarkable is that these two models that really are almost indistinguishable, I mean, there are some preferences, but very, very similar from the CMB temperature power spectra, predict really, really different lensing power spectra. So a universe without dark energy that's curved predicts, in that universe, you'd predict a lot more lensing. So why is that? Well, there's sort of two factors. First of all, a universe without dark energy, if you just look at what it looks like, it's a lot bigger. It has a much lower Hubble constant. The distance to, say, redshift 2 is much larger. So there's a lot more lensing, just because this universe without dark energy has to be a lot bigger. The second effect is not geometric, but is due to the growth of structure. So dark energy suppresses the growth of structure, and that's also reflected in the mass distribution and therefore in the lensing power spectrum. So even in 2011, with our first sort of 4 sigma detection, we were able to, of the lensing power spectrum, we were able to somewhat break this geometric degeneracy. So you can see that our points, because the lensing power spectra are so different, even our sort of first measurement was able to tighten the constraints and break the degeneracy. So here you can see this in the omega lambda, omega matter plane. When I don't add lensing information, when I just have high redshift information, they're degenerate, and I add the lensing information, and the contours shrink, right? So I'm starting to break this degeneracy. And here you can see this most clearly if I plot the 1D posterior probability distribution. So if I just have WMAP in blue, a universe with no dark energy is not really ruled out. But I add the lensing information, which tells me about the low redshift universe from the CMB, and this degeneracy is broken by adding the lensing information. And so for the first time in 2011, with our lensing power spectrum measurements, we had evidence for dark energy from just the CMB alone. So you don't have to add things like supernovae or BAO. You just look at the CMB temperature power spectrum, and you measure the CMB lensing. So you have one data set, and you can obtain constraints on both the low and high redshift universe. And that's a really, I think it's a really nice technique because CMB physics is incredibly well understood. It's a really, really clean probe, and it's under very good theoretical control. We really understand the microwave background, we really understand linear structure formation, and we really understand gravitational lensing, at least in the weak lensing regime. So what's really cool is that the Planck measurements are a huge improvement to this, right? So they redid our analysis, and now this isn't just like a neat curiosity, like, wow, look, we can do this. We can get dark energy from just the CMB. It's now become competitive almost with other probes of the lower redshift universe. It's kind of amazing, right? So if you look at the same contours, right, here's the degeneracy, which is not as strong because you actually have lensing information in the Planck power spectrum. But anyway, if you look at this degeneracy line, then you add the measurement of the lensing power spectrum, the contours shrink dramatically, and you get a constraint on, say, the Hubble constant of, you know, a few kilometers per second per megaparsec. So it really is getting competitive, and, you know, you have evidence for dark energy at well, well above 10 sigma. So this is really precise now. Sure.
When you say this lensing information on the power spectrum, do you mean the lensed TT spectrum at high L?
Mm-hmm.
Is different from the unlensed TT spectrum at high L.
Yes, that's right. So in WMAP, when I showed this degeneracy line, there was almost no lensing information because it was mainly just large scale. But I haven't really talked about this, but the fact that the microwave background is lens also affects the normal plane CMB power spectrum that you're used to. Because basically what's going on is sometimes you see it through a lens and it's sort of a big blob of dark matter, and it's magnified. So the peaks are kind of, all the scales are shifted to low L. And then you see it through an underdensity, and it's kind of demagnified. And so you in different parts of the sky, the power spectrum appears differently, and you have a kind of net smearing of the peak. So that information is in the power spectrum, in the temperature power spectrum, and causes this not to be a perfect degeneracy.
So that doesn't carry as much information as the CLTD does.
Exactly. Okay, so I've talked about how you can measure the lensing power spectrum from CMB temperature maps with ACT and Planck, and what you can get in terms of dark energy constraints and how you can break the geometric degeneracy. Another application that's only just beginning, but I think will possibly be the most interesting application of CMB lensing measurements in the future, is constraints on the masses of neutrinos using CMB lensing measurements. So just to give a bit of background, we know that neutrinos have to have masses due to oscillation experiments, where you have different flavors that are sort of oscillating into each other. But we only really know the differences, or actually the square of the differences, of the neutrino mass. So we only know the differences of the masses. We don't know the absolute scale. And we don't even know what the ordering is exactly or the hierarchy of the different neutrino eigenstates. What's cool is that with CMB lensing measurements, we can constrain and hopefully measure the sum of these neutrino masses. So how does this work? Massive neutrinos, if you look at them on very large scales, the fact that they're kind of moving around and free streaming doesn't matter, right? They just act like normal cold dark matter. You don't see this free streaming. And so they contribute to clustering and the growth of structure. However, on small scales, that kind of stops being true. On small scales, you see the free streaming, and they don't contribute to clustering. They just contribute to the expansion rate, but not the clustering. So the net effect of having massive neutrinos on the dark matter distribution and on the mass distribution is that small scales are suppressed relative to large scales. And that effect becomes stronger the more massive my neutrinos are. And so because it's in the dark matter and in the mass distribution, it also shows up in the Lenzing power spectrum, which tells you a projected version of the matter power spectrum. Okay, so if I dial up the masses of neutrinos, the Lenzing power spectrum gets suppressed on small relative to large scales in the Lenzing power spectrum. And it's actually, you know, by a reasonable amount, roughly 5% per 0.1 eV sum of neutrino masses. And so Planck used this to get sort of a first constraint on the sum of neutrino masses. By using exactly this effect, they compared their Lenzing power spectrum with sort of the theory for different neutrino masses and obtained a constraint. It was just an upper limit, less than 0.85 eV. It's a little bit weaker than you might expect from just doing a forecast. That's partially, you know, with this 5% guideline, partially because it's sort of at lower L where the effect isn't that strong, but mainly because turns out that Lenzing and the other parts of the Planck likelihood, the Planck primary CMB, favor slightly different values of the mass, so there's some kind of tension. The Lenzing power spectrum favors somewhat higher masses, so the constraints will get a lot better, as I'll show later in the talk, though. Okay, so that was kind of the first quick section of my talk discussing measurements of the Lenzing power spectrum and how you can get cosmology from them. Or any quick questions before I talk about cross-correlation science? Okay. So not only can you measure the power spectrum of Lenzing, but you can take your Lenzing map and you can cross-correlate it with, say, galaxies or quasars or another kind of Lenzing or anything that really traces the same underlying mass distribution, and you can obtain a signal and get cosmology out of that. And that's what I'll be talking about now. So the most obvious thing, if you have a Lenzing mass map that you can correlate with that also traces the underlying mass distribution, is another kind of Lenzing measurement. A Lenzing measurement using the distortion of the shapes of galaxies to construct a similar mass map. So, you know, these have really come into their own in recent years. There have been measurements such as CFHT, and we actually measured the correlation now between our ACT-CMB Lenzing map and the CFHT galaxy Lenzing map. And those have sufficient redshift overlap that they should be correlated. So CFHT, these galaxy Lenzing maps, also measure the mass distribution, but at much lower redshift, around 0.5 or below. But there's enough overlap that you can see a correlation. And so we measured this Lenzing cross-correlation for the first time. The paper should be coming out in a couple of weeks. Because it's still using ACT, there's not that much overlap area. It's just around 3.2 sigma, but I think it's a nice detection, and it's consistent with what you expect for this cross-correlation, which also, in a different way, tells you about the matter-power spectrum, tells you about the distribution of mass, by comparing sort of two totally different ways of getting at the mass distribution. And it's nice that they work and overlap, and everything seems to work and agree with what you expect. So this is really cool because it's another way of measuring the mass distribution, another way of measuring the power spectrum, and all the same arguments I've said about how that mass distribution constrains dark energy neutrinos also apply to this cross-correlation. But it's at a different redshift, right? It's kind of in between the redshifts of the galaxy Lenzing, which is very low redshift, and the CMB Lenzing, which is redshift 2 or something. So what that means is, you know, by using these Lenzing cross-correlations, you can start to construct measurements of the amplitude of structure at different redshifts. And you can kind of do tomography. You can look at how big is structure as a function of redshift. And so here I've just, you know, plotted some ACT points. There's another CFHT point on how big the constraint on the amplitude of structure is as a function of redshift. Obviously, you have primordial CMB measurements at redshift around 1,000. And that's going to get a lot better. But the goal is, with these kinds of Lenzing cross-correlations that this is the first example of, is to really construct the growth history of structure across a wide range of redshifts and then constrain things that affect it, like dark energy and neutrino mass. Sure.
What is your signal from CMB lensing? Is it gradient of temperature? You're cross-correlating gradient of temperature with the lensing map? Galaxies?
No, so basically we measure the estimator for CMB lensing is the correlation of the temperature with its gradient. And so then you have a map of lensing, and then you have another map of lensing, which comes from the galaxy side, which comes from the distortions of the galaxy shape. So map of lensing one, map of lensing two, cross-correlate them, get that this signal.
I wonder if gradient of temperature is as degeneracy with the Sonnabend-Zeldovich effect. If you have
right.
a galactic structure.
Yeah, so that's a good question. And that sort of is kind of a system that can be potentially a systematic error for these lensing power spectrum measurements. If other things basically look similar to the distortion of the CMB hot and cold spots that's caused by lensing. So there can be a little bit of sort of confusion, but you can do good estimates for those, and those are very, very small. Those are at the few percent level, and you know there's been a lot of work on that, and it seems really negligible. Yes, very quickly.
How competitive is this tomography now?
With like a galaxy peak lensing tomography as a measure of the growth rate of you know the long delta and the log
N. Well, so galaxy lensing tomography is basically the same idea, right? It's just
this particular measurement. How competitive is that with some lensing tomography?
I mean, I think they're both pretty low signal to noise. I don't think they're gonna. Right now, it's not. I think it's a little lower signal to noise, but it's not. Vastly lower. Both of these techniques are going to improve a lot, though. What's nice, though, about the CMB lensing stuff is that you basically, if you add it to galaxy lensing, you have a really high redshift handle on the amplitude of structure, right? So you can kind of get sort of high redshift lever arm for figuring out how it's grown.
So this is nice for the large scale.
Yeah, I'm just going to talk about that. So the other thing you can do, as Kendrick was saying, is that if you just look at galaxy lensing measurements, they're not expected to be limited by statistical errors because the error bars in the near future will be really, really tiny. But they're expected to be limited by systematic errors. So things like PSF errors or noise rectification bias or other things basically lead to this multiplicative bias. So there's systematic biases that are degenerate with interesting cosmological parameters and that can mess up your measurement. But what's cool is if you add the CMB lensing cross-correlation, the cross-correlation and the galaxy lensing power spectrum depend in different ways on cosmology and this systematic bias. So you can combine them, self-calibrate, and break these degeneracies. And that's going to be really, really important when galaxy surveys are a key, with LSST and Euclid are becoming a sort of key cosmological probe. Okay, so I've talked about cross-correlations of lensing with another form of dark matter. Now let me talk about cross-correlations of lensing with galaxies or quasars or other kind of astronomical objects that trace the dark matter distribution and are therefore correlated with lensing. So why is this interesting for cosmology? Well, as you know, they're not perfect tracers, they're biased. In other words, they're sort of, the overdensities are proportional. And to do cosmology with a lot of sort of large scale structure measurements, you really need to know this bias parameter in order to interpret it. And so if you measure the cross power, if you compare CMB lensing with the distribution of galaxies or quasars and you cross correlate them, you pull out this cross correlation signal, that depends on the bias. So if you measure, the amplitude of a galaxy CMB lensing cross power, you can pull out the bias and measure it and constrain it and use that for cosmology. So here's just a quick example of how you can use measurements of astrophysical galaxy biases for cosmology. Say you measure the biases of Wise galaxies with ACK. You look at the amplitude of this cross power and measure the bias, and then you can use this galaxy sample for cosmology, because you really know how to translate it to the thing you can predict.
How do you know the redshift
distribution of Wise
galaxy?
So you can do cross-matching with Sloan, for instance. The thing is that, so that's less important for the cross power, though, because the kind of CMB lensing as kernel is very wide, so you're not very sensitive to redshift errors. But you can do cross-matching. Cross-matching with Sloan is the main way.
Sorry, what's
the
n by the
z?
Is that like a
mass
function?
No, that is just the redshift distribution of the galaxies. You know, just what redshifts they lie at. Okay, and anyway, you can, if you want to do something like measure the ISW effect, which I'm not going to go into a huge amount of detail, but you know, we have a paper coming out where we measure the ISW effect to 3 sigma, that's sort of an effect caused by dark energy. You also measure it in a galaxy cross-correlation, and in order to interpret it, you need to know the galaxy bias. And so to do interesting cosmological measurements with galaxies like that, it's really useful to know the galaxy bias. And so we calibrated this bias with CMU lensing. I'm not going to go into a huge amount of detail on this, though.
Why Q-band doesn't apply?
We have all the bands, and I picked out one that looked nice. That's the answer. I can show you B or whatever. I don't know. Anyway. I've talked about cross correlations with CMB lensing in sort of three different ways. First of all, you can just measure the dark matter distribution with lensing cross correlations. Then you can measure bias parameters of galaxies in order to do cosmology. But in a way, the third way is that you can actually use this bias as a signal, and that mainly tells you about astrophysics, right? And the reason the bias is also a signal and not just a nuisance parameter, a sort of annoying systematic that you want to get rid of. Is that it can be related, say you look at the bias of the quasar distribution to the dark matter distribution, this bias can be related to how massive are the dark matter halos that these quasars live in. So bias of astrophysical objects is a really interesting parameter, and so if you measure it with a cross-correlation, you can figure out what kind of dark matter halos objects live in. So here's sort of the... Here's a measurement of the cross power between ACT CMB lensing measurements and the spatial distribution of quasars. And again, you measure this cross power, you pull out the bias, and now you can learn something about astrophysics. You can learn, you know, what masses dark matter halos do quasars live in. And you can do other things, like you can say, compare different populations of quasars, measure their biases, figure out what kind of halo masses they live in. This was sort of done with type 1 and type 2 quasars, and people check whether they live in the same kind of halo. So it's a very, very powerful astrophysical tool because you can compare and correlate the distribution of astronomical objects with dark matter. You can figure out the relation between the luminous objects and the underlying dark matter distribution.
Can you build up the nonlinear mass?
So the scales are somewhat large for CMB lensing. You can, if you stack, for instance, clusters it's not the best way to do it. So just to sum up what I've talked about so far, you can measure the CMB lensing power spectrum with the temperature and get great constraints on both dark energy and neutrinos. And you can cross-correlate lensing maps with either other kinds of lensing or with large-scale structure, and that tells you about both cosmology and astrophysics. Okay, so that sort of brings us to today. CMB lensing has been kind of going on for around 5 years now, at least on the data analysis side, from Kendrick's first detection to the sort of Planck power spectrum measurement through our ACT lensing power spectrum first detection. But this is only the beginning. And at the end of my talk, I'll just discuss why lensing science is going to expect it to improve by a huge amount. And one of the main reasons we expect it to get a lot better in the near future is because we'll have information about how lensing affects the CMB polarization. We'll have measurements of CMB lensing, not just through CMB temperature, but through polarization. So just as a reminder, you can describe the CMB polarization pattern, which is sort of described with polarization directions indicated in these rods, you can split this polarization pattern into an E-mode polarization pattern, which has sort of even parity, is even under reflection, and a B-mode pattern. And that is fantastic for lensing because you know that on small scales, all the B modes, on small scales, there's no primordial B. Okay? So on small scales, originally, all the patterns you make are like this. But lensing changes that. Lensing shifts around these nice, even E-mode patterns and turns a little bit of the E-mode pattern into a B-mode pattern. So what that means is that whenever you see a small-scale B-mode, you know it's due to lensing. And that really helps you because it gives you additional statistical information that allows you to reconstruct lensing better. So effectively, you know, if I look at a temperature fluctuation pattern, I never really know, does it look like that because it's lensed, or did the hot and cold spots happen to fluctuate like that? But if I see a B mode, I know it's due to lensing. So you can write down estimators for the lensing deflection using not just the temperature, but using E and B polarization. And that allows you to reconstruct the mass at much higher resolution. So polarization will really improve. Measurements of CMB lensing and polarization will really improve on measurements in temperature. And so I've now recently been working on measuring this in practice, developing pipelines for small-scale CMB experiments. So one of these small-scale CMB experiments is Polar Bear. It measures polarization and not just temperature on small areas. And collaborators and I have developed a pipeline that actually, you know, measures the lensing in an unbiased and optimal way, even for these small maps. So you can see our pipeline recovers the true lensing convergence power that's put into the simulations, and its noise level agrees with the forecast for the optimal theory. So what are we going to do with these first polarization lensing measurements with Polar Bear? Well, our first step will be to provide additional channels to measure the B-mode polarization. Right? So these lensing-induced B-modes haven't really, are only starting to be seen now. And there are three ways to detect them and compare them with theory. The first one is you measure the B-mode power spectrum. But then you can also just measure polarization lensing reconstruction and either cross-correlate it with galaxies or measure the lensing power spectrum. And these are all channels that tell us, you know, about have we detected lensing B-modes and do they look the way we expect. So I've mainly been working on this cross-correlation channel. So the idea is that you measure polarization lensing that, and you cross-correlate it with galaxies, in particular with galaxies from Herschel. And if you see it, you know you found B-modes, and you can check that their amplitude agrees with what you expect. So the galaxies we're cross-correlating with are Herschel galaxies that give you infrared background maps, because these are most correlated. So we expect a first, or you know, actually SBT did this recently, but sort of three different channels of measurements involving B-mode power. And we expect roughly a 3-sigma detection through this cross-correlation channel, where we measure polarization lensing and cross-correlate it with large-scale structure. And if we see that signal, it means we've detected B-modes. And if the amplitude agrees with what we expect, that confirms that we understand how lensing B-modes are produced, and we understand everything. But so hopefully, soon, we'll use polarization lensing to detect B-modes in these three channels. But not only is obviously lensing reconstruction interesting for, you know, doing this B-mode detection, but of course the main goal, the main gain from measurements of lensing and polarization is that they increase the precision of your measurement for the reasons I've explained earlier. And so in the last couple of slides, I'll talk about what kind of cosmological constraints we can get from CMB polarization lensing measurements. All right? So this is sort of going to be the future of CMB lensing measurements using polarization. And I'll give some examples on just how good the constraints are that we can expect in the next few years. So this is one of these surveys that's going to measure the polarization on much of the sky and will allow us to measure the lensing and map the mass on much of the sky. known as ACTPOL. It's basically a polarization-sensitive upgrade to ACT. And we'll measure polarization on many thousands of square degrees of sky that will also overlap with lots of large-scale structure surveys. So if you remember, our first detection was around 4 sigma. It's kind of amazing that this, you know, we're expecting to get measurements like this in a couple of years, so which will be at least 50 sigma. So very, very precise, you know, 2% measurements of the amplitude of the lensing power spectrum. And as you can imagine, when in a year or two we have these measurements of the lensing power spectrum, this will be very constraining on things like neutrino mass and dark energy properties. So in just a couple of years, we expect to get constraints around 0.07 eV on the neutrino mass. And that's starting to get to a regime where we basically have to detect something. We have to see the mass of the neutrinos. And again, as Kendrick indicated, and I discussed earlier, possibly even more interesting will be the cross-correlations of CMB lensing with galaxy weak lensing surveys from things like LSST and HSC. Because you can sort of use the fact that CMB lensing is a really well-understood calibrator to allow those future surveys to realize their full potential. So for instance, with LSST, CMB lensing measurements should give roughly a 3 to 10 a factor of 3 to 10 improvement in the dark energy figure of merit. So you really expect huge gains in cosmological constraints, both through measurements of the lensing power spectrum and through measurements of cross-correlations in the next couple of years. And this is going to be fantastic for astrophysics, also through cross-correlations. So it's worth emphasizing that CMB lensing measurements are really a direct measurement of the mass at high redshifts. And it's sort of the only game in town for measuring mass at high redshifts. So if you want to know about astrophysics at high redshifts, it's really interesting. And this is a great redshift range if you're interested in things like, you know, how do stars form and quasars and how do galaxies evolve? Because, you know, high redshifts around 1 or 2 are where quasar activity peak and galaxies formation and star formation peak. So it's a really new window on high redshift astrophysics that will allow us to really directly probe with cross-correlations the relation of luminous objects to the underlying dark matter distribution. And we can do this for galaxies with Bosch LRGs. We can do this for gas in the Lyman alpha forest. We can study quasar properties by correlating with Bosch quasars. And we can study star formation by cross-correlating with the infrared background. So it's sort of a new window on astrophysics at high redshift, in addition to all the cosmological constraints that I talked about earlier. And this is all just coming up very soon. From a more kind of conceptual point of view, I think it's amazing. It's also just really interesting that we're going to be able to map the mass over much of the sky. I think it's just really cool that in a couple of years, we'll have a measurement of the dark matter distribution all the way out to really high redshifts over many, many thousand square degrees of sky. And it's not unrealistic that with CMB lensing, in a few years, we'll have a mapped basically all the mass in the universe over much of the sky. A little bit exaggerated, but not that much. So this sort of plot summarizes sort of the last part of my talk, which is saying, you know, how great the constraints are going to be in the next couple of years on cosmology. So this is a plot that shows the signal to noise on this lensing power spectrum, which is this key cosmology observable that depends on all these things. The signal to noise on this lensing power spectrum is a function of what experiment you're looking at. So it's kind of amazing. We've gone in a few years from our first measurement of the power spectrum at 4 sigma to Planck. So there's been a lot of progress recently. But that is expected to continue. So Planck is really only sort of the end of the beginning for measurements of the lensing power spectrum. And so this increase in signal to noise by roughly an order of magnitude will tell us a huge amount about neutrino masses, about dark energy, and about fundamental physics in other ways. And cross-correlations will tell us about astrophysics at high redshift. So there's a lot of great science coming up with CMB lensing measurements in just the next few years. So thank you very much.
Seven eV for the neutrino mass.
Yeah, that's.
Should I think of that as being that's sort of Yeah, when will we get that? That's a projected one sigma error bar.
Yeah, and probably like a year or two time scale. But this is a little bit conservative because we might actually, this is assuming we can only observe at night. We might be able to observe during the day and go observe an even wider field. So we might be able to do better than this, even in the short term. If you look at forecasts with something which are on the 3-4 year time scale, so something like Advanced ACPOL, which a proposal was recently submitted for, so that's around 0.03 EV. And so when you get that, you really have to basically nail down, you know, what's the mass and what's the hierarchy, possibly.
So if the lowest neutrino mass is zero, what is the sum? It's 0.05 EV.
Yeah, that's right.
So it's a little bit below that if it's as low as possible.
Yeah. I mean, right. So if it's an inverted hierarchy, though, it's twice that, right? Because so it's either 0.05 or 0.1.
Oh, yeah.
And if it's in between, you can nail down which of the hierarchies it is.
Okay. And that's one sigma or two sigma?
This is one sigma.
Okay.
So
it's a very tantalizingly close.
I mean, if it's the minimal mass, then, you know, we might get hints or something in the next couple of years. If it's something higher, we'll nail it down.
So you made a very strong statement, which is that there's no way that there are B modes that are due to primordial sources that can be detectable with these methods. So let me push back on that and ask the question. Let's say I believe in some crazy model of the early universe,
mm-hmm.
which I can't tell you which model that is because I don't have one, that has a blue tensors.
Okay.
How well can you constrain that by cross-correlating the B-mode polarization with the lensing signal? So if you don't get what you expect, some fraction of that power spectrum in my crazy model is due to blue tensors.
Okay.
Do you have an idea of how well you could constrain such a crazy model?
Well, so that crazy model would give you CLBB, right? So you would see B mode power spectrum.
Right.
I measure the polarization B modes on the sky. I can just measure them. And then I plot the power spectrum. And because I have these B modes, they'll show up, right? I'll have like a tail and it'll be high. You can sort of distinguish it from the lensing ones because it'll affect the lensing estimators differently, right? So if I measure the lensing map from my usual estimators, they'll be a little bit messed up, but they won't be messed up in just the right way as if it were actually lensing induced, right? So I guess the answer is that crazy model will affect the three different channels differently, and it'll allow you can distinguish, I guess, between those two models. For instance, something like a cross-correlation, the cross-correlation with large-scale structure only knows about the lensing-induced B-modes. It doesn't know about the primordial B-modes.
Right.
So that, for instance, will let you distinguish.
Right, so the cross-correlation would be different than you expect.
For instance,
has anyone looked at how well you could constrain the tilt for tensors?
People haven't even measured any of this stuff. We're only working on this now. What?
Or
oh, no.
Even bigger than S to plus one to be detectable, by these small.
So it was just saying we should do that.
I think that the primordial tensor mode would have to be quite blue, like not just a little bit blue, but NT greater than one or NT greater or almost two or something to actually be predict something that's comparable to the lensing EV spectrum. And
well, it's the cross-correlation that's important, right? So
well,
it
could
be
also
in BB. You wouldn't see it in BB, but maybe you could detect it in the cross-correlation.
Yeah. So let's say if it was, you know...
So why would they detect it in cross-correlation?
It would just affect
because it's
different,
set in, right? It's a different...
No, but I mean, cross-correlation is because lensing happens at low redshift universe, so you cross-correlate low redshift phases with higher redshift then. I mean, the quantum part.
So the primordial, the blue primordial part wouldn't show up.
Wouldn't show up in cross.
Yeah, no, it wouldn't, right? So you can compare, right? That's the idea, right? You can distinguish. You can distinguish B modes from lower redshift from B modes that are originally there. I guess. I mean, I'm just sort of. I haven't thought about this for more than about 30 seconds.
But there are sources of B modes of that sort. Like, I mean, these phase transitions in our universe do generate B modes of small scales, like
sure.
Like alternative models of biogenesis and things. Already for big.
Yeah, I'm sort of assuming the most minimal kind of cosmological model. But I do think this, the statement that it won't have exactly the same effect as lensing-induced B-modes. For instance, it won't be correlated with large-scale structure. And I would suspect that roughly the size of the effect, you know, you might be able, if you look at the error bar on CLBB, that'll roughly set how big a deflection or a deviation you could measure, I would just guess. Sure.
Do you know how dependent the forecast there for the neutrinos, for example, or other things, how dependent they are on the nonlinear matter power spectrum, or how well you model that, on, you know, whether you use a fit or an M-body or something like
right.
that?
Right.
How sensitive are they to the.
So, small actually, not very. CME lensing really mainly probes kind of linear or kind of just nonlinear scales. It's not very sensitive to the very, very nonlinear scales. Yes, partially. Just, you know, the limber thing picks out. And, you know, that makes it a lot easier because I think, you know, we don't. At least we think we understand, you know, how neutrinos behave on sort of linear or next to linear scales. If you measure, say, with galaxy lensing, then you have to be a little more careful because you can have things like neutrinos orbiting and halos and all kinds of crazy stuff happening. So I think for CME lensing, we're sort of okay.
Any more questions? Okay, so before we have that again, we'll be having dinner. With Blake and Bistro this evening, like 6:30 in the Bistro this evening.
I let him piss for it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
For students and postdocs.
No joke. For anyone, I do pay for it. Yes, that's right. For
Yeah,
it also does, but anyway, it's free. That's the bottom line.
Yeah, free for students and postdocs. So do come along and I get to chat to Blake more about. Otherwise, well, so let's thank Blake.